Welcome back to TRP.
Hi, welcome back to the Rosslare podcast. Today, Dr. Noel Cutterton discusses Richard Strauss, Pietro Mascagni, and Hector Berlioz. Noel, could you tell me a little bit about Richard Strauss?
Yeah, Richard Strauss was a German composer. I have to say at the start now, he's no relation to Johann Strauss and the Waltz family Strausses. He comes from a completely different family. He was born in 1864. He was the son of a prominent musician, and he quickly made himself a reputation as for writing orchestral works and the odd opera. But things like Don Juan and Death and Transfiguration are works that are played a lot today. He earned a living by conducting his own music and other people's music when he started off. When he was 30, he was rehearsing his own new opera called Guntram. And the soprano part was sung by a girl who he had met previously. Her name was Pauline Dehanna. Now, he fancied her rotten. He really liked her. But during the rehearsal, she was a diva. And during the rehearsal, she was extremely difficult and contrary. She reckoned that Strauss was ignoring her. And at one stage, she got the book of the opera and threw it at him, and flounced off the stage and went off to her dressing room in high dudgeon. The poor old Harry Strauss scurried out after her. When they were gone, the orchestra were there saying, "This is just not good enough. We're not going to stay here. Unless she apologises for her terrible behaviour, we're out of here." So Strauss came back, and they said, "Before we start again," the orchestra said, "we want to tell you, we don't like the way she treated you, and we want a public apology from her." He said, "God, or if not, we're out of here." And he said, "Lord, that'd be an awful pity, because we've just got engaged to be married." And they got married the following year. Now, this woman, she was a strong-willed, dominating woman. And she was the driving force behind the marriage. She arranged all his social engagements, planned every day for him, sent him off with his pocket money here there every day. And if his music wasn't good enough, she criticised it, and he accepted that criticism very meekly. She was ill-tempered and outspoken. One day, one of his operas was being performed, one stormy night, and the opera did not go well. And they were coming home in the taxi. The storm was hurtling outside, and they had an almighty row. And the taxi driver who was driving him was said to have remarked that it was stormier inside the car than it was outside. But anyway, despite the very turbulent relationship, they were deeply in love. They never strayed. They were extremely happy. And she had a massive influence on the music that he wrote. She taught him about the power and the beauty and the potential of the female voice. And this is evident, very evident, in lots of his operas. Some of the powerful roles he composed for sopranos. An opera like Salome, and there's a famous opera called The Rosencavalier, which has some beautiful singing, and he was very much influenced by her. Anyway, he got on with his life, and he became the most prominent composer in Germany. Music was all that mattered to him. He paid no attention in the wide earthly world to the world around him. All he concerned about was the music he was writing and the performances in the theatres that were putting on his music. He remained completely oblivious to the rise of Hitler and Nazis. And in fact, to his eternal shame, he actually, in 1935, he collaborated with them. And that did not go down well with anybody. He lost a lot of friends. But in fairness, he thought he had outlived other political administrations. He thought he'd play a few tunes for these boys and they'd just leave him alone. But he didn't realise just how crowded thugs he was dealing with. When he did realise it in about 1935-36, he scorned them and had nothing more to do with them for the rest of the war. But nonetheless, that collaboration was a shadow over him for the rest of his career. And at the end of the war, he was brought before a tribunal, and he was completely cleared. He was cleared of all collaboration. His reputation was saved. Nonetheless, I think even to this day, there are people say, did he or did he not? Was he or was he not a Nazi? But in my opinion, he was a big family man. He actually had a relation who was married to a Jew, and he collaborated with him on an opera. And the Nazis wanted him to take down the collaboration with that Jew, and he didn't do it. So he had even though he had only one child, he had an extended family, and they were all there were lots of Jewish connections, and he stood by them. So I honestly feel it was naivety and innocence and just completely ignoring the world around him that he did what he did. He survived the war but died in 1949 with his reputation dubious, let's say. In 1948 he died. He completed what I think is his best work is called Four Last Songs for Soprano and Orchestra. It is reckoned he wrote them in honour of his wife, who had taught him so much, and I think those songs will be remembered for their great, great beauty.
And that was Four Last Songs, recorded by the Munich Philharmonic Orchestra with Christian Thielemann conducting, sung by René Fleming. Noel, I'd like to ask you now about Mascagni. Can you tell me about him?
Yeah, the Italian composer Pietro Mascagni. His father was a baker and he fully expected the young Pietro to follow him into the family business. Pietro had other ideas. He had nothing in his head, only music, and he wanted to become a musician. A local aristocrat heard some of his early compositions, was impressed, and funded his musical education. And at least he learned his trade. After college, he got several different jobs. None of them paid well. He was poor. He was living a hand-to-mouth existence. He then met a girl, as we do. Marcellina Carbognani was her name. But she's called Lina, her friends, and he called her Lina. Affectionately. And they married and they rapidly had three children. Now, if he was poor before, he was even poorer now, and they were living on the clippings of tin. One day when he was 27 years of age, he saw an ad in the newspaper stating that a publishing house was offering a prize for a one-act opera. They would guarantee that opera would be staged. And he thought, this is manna from heaven for me. This is what I want to do. So he decided there and then that he would write an opera. He came across a novel written by a guy called Giovanni Verga. He was from Sicily. And that time there was a fashion for real life, visceral kind of stories about death and killing and real life rather than sort of make-believe romantics. It was a realist school of novel writing, they called it. And Madame Bovary was another one. That's the kind of stuff that was being written. So he took to this opera, and he took to this story like a duck to water, and he decided that he'd make an opera out of the story. He sat down in his office and he wrote for 80 days and he poured his heart and soul into this opera. He called it Cavaliere Rusticana. That's the name of the opera. The trouble was, as soon as he finished with it, he said, oh my God, this is terrible. I don't like this. He lost all faith in it. He said, this is just not good enough. And he said, he'd write something else for the competition. And he threw it in the drawer and quickly forgot about it. And this is where Lena stepped in, the wife. She took the manuscript out of the drawer and she posted it off to the publisher without him knowing anything at all about it. Can you imagine his surprise? A couple of weeks later, he picked up the newspaper and then he won the wretched competition. Over 72 other entries, he won it. A few months later, the opera was performed immediately. A few months later, it was performed in Rome. The response was immediate and overwhelming in its enthusiasm. After the performance, he took 40 curtain calls. The just audience wouldn't let him home. Soon after that, he was made an honorary citizen of the city, and the citizens held torch-like processions for him in his honour. Within a few months, it became one of the most frequently performed operas in the major opera houses all over Europe. Overnight, he came from living in near poverty to superstardom, beyond his wildest dreams. It was a dream come true. The opera is very short. It's a one-act opera. And when it is performed nowadays on stage, it's accompanied by a second opera called Il Pagliacci by the composer Ruggero Leoncavallo. And the two operas nowadays are affectionately called Cav and Mag, and you'd see them being performed all over the world. He went on to write 14 other operas. Some of them are good, some of them not so good. For instance, there's a comic opera called L'Amico Fritz, which I think has some beautiful music, but none of them caused the level of excitement that Cavalieri did. None of them achieved the same fame. And this has led to him unfairly being called a one-trick pony. But he was anything but. Some of his operas are good, but he also became a very famous conductor and introduced lots of great music into Italy. So he was well-known, but nowadays he's probably known only for the Cav, that short one-act opera, and a few bits and pieces out of a few bits and other pieces of other operas. However, in the late 30s, he made a big error. He became enthusiastic about fascism and used his music to curry favour with the fascists and Mussolini and all of those. He used to send Mussolini presents and that kind of stuff. He became a mouthpiece for them. And this was a fatal error. He lost popularity with his fellow artists and the music going public. He gradually slipped into obscurity and he died in 1945, almost forgotten, embittered and penniless and on his own in a hotel in Rome. The strange thing about it, when in a few years of his death, his opera was being performed all over opera houses across Europe and America and everywhere, and it still continues to be this day.
Thank you.
That exquisite piece was Intermezzo, taken from Cavalleria Rusticana, played on cello by Hauser. I'm going to just jump the gun a bit here. I'm going to go to Hector Berlioz. Can you tell me about him?
Hector Berlioz was a fascinating character. Hector Berlioz was French, and he was one of these guys that never did things by halves. He was very emotional. He could be elated one minute and the depths of depression the next. He, in the bat of an eye, his humour could change. He fell out with nearly everybody in the course of his life. He fell out with his family, his friends, the musical establishment, and he was just one of these characters. But he was also very eccentric. In 1827, when he was 24 years of age, he was a struggling composer, and he went to, an English touring company doing Shakespeare in Paris, and he went to see Hamlet. And there was an Irish girl called Harriet Smithson, she was from Clare, beautiful looking girl, playing the part of Ophelia. And there and then, the bold Berlioz fell head over heels in love with her. No messing, his world had changed utterly. He went again the following night, and I think she was playing Romeo and Juliet. And he went cracked. He stalked her with letters, he lived quite close to her, followed her movements, watched everything she did. The poor creature went nuts. She was being stalked by a madman, as far as she's concerned. She took flight and disappeared into the hill, disappeared into the provinces in France to go continue touring. And he was absolutely devastated, threatened suicide, and was in an awful state. But out of that came one of the best pieces of music, I'd say, was ever written. He called it the Symphonie Fantastique, the Fantastic Symphony. And that's what it was. It was about a man who was obsessed with love, took drugs, had weird dreams, dreamt about killing her lover and being hauled off to the scaffold and all that kind of stuff. It's incredible music. But anyway, somehow or other, he got over all that. And he got a prize to go to Spain, he got a prize from the French government to go to Rome to study. And Berlioz being Berlioz, he didn't like Rome at all. He spent most of his time in St. Peter's Basilica in the confession box because it was nice and cool reading novels and dreaming about Harriet. But anyway, he eventually came back to Paris, and now his star was beginning to rise a little bit. And while her star was declining, French audiences got a little tired of her. But she went to one of his concerts, and she realised that the music was written for her. So she agreed to meet. And this time they met, and lo and behold, they decided to get married. And get married they did, after a couple of weeks, in the face of huge opposition from both families. Now, you know, it was never going to work. She knew no French. He knew no English. He was at the start of his career, so he was out all the time promoting his stuff. She was always at home. She got into drinking a fair lot. And the rows between them used to be volcanic. It was just incredible. And eventually, they split.
Did they have children?
They had one child. But they split up anyway. But in fairness to him, he was very good to her. And as she died, he always looked after her with great tenderness until she died.
Was she older than him?
Oh, she was a good deal older. I can't remember how many years. I think she was in nine. I'm not sure. But he married a second time. And they say he married a woman who was a singer. But they say her ambition was bigger than her voice. You know. But needless to say, that marriage didn't work out either. But he went on to write some beautiful music. The two wives died. He was on his own. His son died he became a sailor and died far away, and so he died lonely and wasn't too unhappy to die, I think, at the end of his life. He had fought with so many people, and his music, he never felt that he was appreciated in his home country. The French never took to his music like he thought they should and what they have done since. So he died a lonely old man. But boy, could he write music. And in his day, it didn't get much better than him.
So when you say a lonely old man, I mean, he didn't have money then at the end of his life.
No, and very few of those composers made a lot of money. Very few of them, no. He did all right. He made a living as a critic. And boy, could he criticise. You know, he really let fly. He had really high standards. And that's how he made a lot of his enemies, that when he criticised other music, he went at it. He didn't hold back or anything like that. So he was an extraordinary, vibrant, difficult, fantastic man.
Do you think a lot of the top musicians were taking some form of drug at the time?
I don't think so. A lot of them fond of drinking and things like that, but he was probably... No, I don't think... Not drugs now as such, that I'm aware of. A lot of them drank a lot at times, all right, but no, I'm not convinced they were taking a lot of drugs. I don't know if Berlioz did either, but I suspect he did. He took all sorts of strange substances at the time. He was in love with Harriet and could do nothing about it, you know.
That was Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra conductor George Solti. Tune in again next week, where we'll be discussing Irish and female composers.
Keep listening to TRP.